The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
Alrighty then. Good morning. We are underway at 7 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock on this Wednesday, the 17th morning of the fourth month in the year of our Lord 2024. Thank you so much for joining us. We got a lot to do today. And I mean a lot. It's been a very, very busy news cycle over the last 24, and we had ourselves a little event at Kent last night, and we have to talk about that too. On the program today at 9:45, so about half an hour plus from now. We will talk to Congressman Jim Jordan. Looking forward to that. He's got a lot of things to answer for. Well, not him personally, but to talk about from the House side of things. At 10:35, we're going to talk to Gorka. Not that one. His better half, Kate Gorka. And I'll explain why in just a little while. But those are the guests today. And then, of course, you are our most important guest each and every day whenever you feel like being one. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. Either number gets you here. I had a guy at the Kyle Rittenhouse event last night. A listener came up to me and said, Bob, I don't understand. Every time I try to call you, I get a this number cannot be completed as dialed message. Can't seem to get through. He's not the first person to tell me that. I don't know what to tell you. It's the number, 216-901-0945. It really is. And if that one doesn't work, you can try the other one that I just mentioned, 888-281-1110. But I have had people say that in the past. I don't know why, but just I'm just going to ask you to be diligent and vigilant and stick with it and keep trying to get through whenever the need arises. I just don't know what to tell you, but I promise you we're not turning the phones off at various points in time. Even if we're locked up in a full interview show, if we're going to do interview after interview back to back to back to back to back and no calls at all, we still have the phone lines open for you to see and call and talk to Marianne and just engage in a little bit of banter and tell her what you want her to tell me. So we still keep the phones open. But anyway, we'll try to get you on the program today. In fact, we have plenty of opportunities as we have just two guests today. Again, Jim Jordan and Kate Gorka, the wife of Dr. Sebastian Gorka, will be on the program. We've got a recap of last night's events in Kent to get to, but we don't do anything before we do our top nine at nine. And we don't do the top nine at nine until we do our pledge. Patriots, stand and face your flag if you've got one nearby. If you don't, let's work on that. Put your hand on your heart and join us for this pledge. If you are a believer in surrendering American sovereignty, surrendering American security, otherwise known if you are a Democrat and you don't love this country, then that's fine. Don't fake it. Just take a knee so we can identify you as the Marxist dog that you are. For the rest of us, however,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, let's dive right in.
It's 9 o'clock. Do you know where your headlines are? We do. It's time for the Top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio.
These are the top headlines for me today, things that I want to talk about. We'll see what you think.
Number 1.
In the wake of countless controversial decisions and a growing split among congressional Republicans over spending and constitutional issues, Congressman Thomas Massey from Kentucky is calling on Speaker Mike Johnson to get the hell out.
There's only one person right now who can stop us from going into what happened last fall, and that's Mike Johnson. He's cleaning the barn, that's obvious.
You want him to resign? You want him to resign?
Yes. Yeah, I asked him to resign.
What did he say?
He said he would not. And then he said, well, you're the one who's going to put us into this. Because the motion is going to get called, okay? Does anybody doubt that? The motion will get called, and then he's going to lose more votes than Kevin McCarthy. And I have told him this in private. Like,
Speaker Mike Johnson has already been under fire from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has indeed called for Johnson to be replaced, just as he replaced Kevin McCarthy. I knew this was going to be a bad situation from the beginning. The split in the Republican Party is only going to damage the brand. Now 6.5 months away from deciding who controls Congress. In November, we will have to decide, the people of this country will have to decide which party should control Congress. And this is what the Republicans look like right now. An absolute disaster. Sorry, it's reality.
Number 2.
Former President Trump visited a bodega in New York City yesterday, the one where a worker was attacked and robbed and then wrongfully prosecuted by Manhattan District Attorney Fat Alvin Bragg. Prior to his visit, Trump issued a press release revealing that he'd be visiting that bodega where Jose Alba, who was working there as a clerk, was robbed and attacked and wrongfully accused of murder. Trump's visit to one of New York City's bodegas comes at a time when retail theft is skyrocketing, and the New York City police force is on track to fall to its lowest numbers since the 1990s, according to Trump's press release. We know why Trump went to this bodega, because Fat Alvin literally wanted to charge a crime victim with murder. He continues to let actual criminals go free, and now he's bootstrapping a bunch of misdemeanor charges, which is what should be aimed at Trump, to felonies so that he can lock him up. Shining a spotlight on the incompetence of Alvin Bragg. Good job, President Trump.
Number 3.
As day 2 of the Trump hush money criminal trial, prosecuted by attorneys for the former president had a juror dismissed after they found posts calling for Trump to be put in jail. As the judge and the attorneys and prosecutors and Bragg's office continue the process of questioning potential jurors about posts they made on social media and their private lives, Trump's legal team had a juror dismissed who said he would be totally impartial about Trump, about a post that they found on him online calling for Trump to be locked up. Another social media post from the same juror said, "Get him out now," when Trump was president. The first 7 jurors have been seated. Over 2 days, dozens of potential jurors have been excused after saying they could not be impartial or they had other commitments. Trump lawyers challenged a handful of people over their social media posts, including one who was dismissed over a 2017 post about Trump that also said lock him up. So they are lying, many of them, to try to get on the jury because they want to do what they said online, which is to lock him up. This is an absolute embarrassment in the United States criminal justice system.
Number 4.
On Tuesday, the GOP-led House transmitted impeachment charges against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over his handling of the border crisis to the Democrat-controlled Senate. GOP leaders are concerned that Democrats, who have long called the impeachment inquiry a political stunt, will try to cut short the process before a vote can be held on whether to convict or acquit him. After months of investigation, the House narrowly passed 2 impeachment articles in February. They accused Mayorkas of willfully and systematically refusing to comply with federal immigration laws, and they allege he breached the public trust with false statements about obstructing lawful oversight of the Department of Homeland Security. He absolutely should be in prison for what he has done to the border and to our national security.
Number 5.
Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee is planning new legislative action that will threaten to cut NPR's federal funding. This prompted by the news that it suspended an editor who went viral for exposing the outlet's partisan uniformity in its newsroom. The mainstream media has become obsessed with doing the left's bidding, Blackburn said, and taking down strong conservatives, and NPR has led the pack. It makes no sense that the American people are forced to fund a propagandist left-wing news outlet that refuses to represent the voices of half the country. NPR should not receive our tax dollars. I would just like to say, I completely concur. Thank you, Senator Blackburn. By the way, that is one of the questions that I will be asking Jim Jordan coming up at 9:45 this morning on the House side of things. Will he, and is there enough support for a defunding of NPR?
Number six.
Google employees occupied the California office of Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian for more than 8 hours, demanding that Google stop doing business with Israel. The protests were announced in internal emails to employees that shared a list of demands, including that Google drop its $1.2 billion contract with Israel for Project Nimbus, which is a cloud computing project of the Israeli government. Demands also include that Google cease all business with the Israel apartheid government, as they say it, see it, and military. Stop the harassment, intimidation, and bullying and silencing of Palestinian and Muslim employees, and address the health and safety crisis among workers who are rattled over their labor being used to, quote, enable a genocide. I would just like to point out that Google is the most powerful company in the world. Why? They control all of the news and the flow of information that Americans receive. The aforementioned Trump jury selection trials, part of the Trump trial, of the seven who have been seated thus far, jurors who have been seated thus far, five of them admitted they get their news from A, the New York Times, and B, from Google. Yeah, that's going to be a fair and impartial jury, huh?
Number seven.
Joe Biden is really wading into the deep waters now. He is calling for the WNBA players to be paid what they deserve. As a debate raged online about the salaries in the WNBA after Caitlin Clark, the number one draft pick, Biden's ex-account fired off a post regarding women's sports, stating, quote, "Women in sports continue to push new boundaries and inspire us all. But right now we're seeing that even if you're the best, women are not paid their fair share. It's time that we give our daughters the same opportunities as our sons and ensure women are paid what they deserve," end quote. Two things. One, how is Joe Biden now going to profess his concern for women's sports when he and his administration and his party literally want males to invade those women's sports and boot them from their rightful place and the opportunities that they have? That's number one. And number two, paid their fair share? What the hell are you suggesting, that the government actually issue salary tiers for private companies? Lest he misunderstand, the WNBA is a private league. It is funded by the NBA. The NBA pays those players in the WNBA what they can afford to pay them based on the revenue that they generate, which is based on the number of tickets they sell and the amount of ratings that they drive. Suggesting that they are being paid less because they are women and not because nobody wants to watch them is one of the dumbest things Joe Biden has ever said. And we are talking about Joe Biden here. I'll have more on that subject a little bit later on.
Number eight.
MSNBC lunatic Joe Scarborough has a question for you about your upbringing if you happen to be a Trump voter. Here's what he wants to know.
You live in the most powerful, greatest country on the face of the earth? And you're voting for a guy that tells you every day that America sucks? What's wrong with you? Who raised you? What history did you read?
That's it.
Like, where are you from? Because you may claim to be from where I'm from, but you were not raised by the same teachers I was raised by.
Number one, he is questioning your upbringing, your parents, the job that they did, where they raised you, how they raised you if you were a Trump voter. Number two, he said he was raised by his teachers, not his parents, by his teachers. That says an awful lot. I have a response for Joe Scarborough that I will give a little bit later in the program. But that's a headline in the top nine.
Number nine.
And the last one. A majority of Supreme Court justices appeared skeptical yesterday of the government's broad reading of a statute used to charge hundreds of the January 6th defendants. Joseph Fisher, the defendant in the case, Fisher versus the United States, actually he's the plaintiff, argued that the statute he was charged under was expanded beyond its intended purpose of targeting crimes and evidence tampering. Multiple conservative justices pressed the Solicitor General on whether the government's interpretation of the statute, which enabled it to charge Fisher and others for obstructing Congress's certification of the election, would sweep in a range of other protest activities. For example, would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify, Justice Gorsuch asked? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify? Or at the State of the Union address? End quote. The statute threatens to levy up to 20 years in prison against anyone who corruptly obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. So that's a very, very good sign for the J6ers that multiple Supreme Court justices yesterday seemed to have some real questions about whether or not this is right. And there you have it.
This has been the Top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio. AM 1420. The answer.
All right, that's the top 9 and 9 for today. We will talk about some of these things in a while. We do have Jim Jordan coming up at 9:45. I got done with a little bit early this morning, so that I would have a few minutes here before the bottom of the hour to talk about last night. First of all, a thank you to listeners. I don't know how many of them there were in the crowd in what eventually became a packed auditorium. They really took their time in terms of allowing people through the metal detector you had to walk through and to be, you know, cleared by security to get inside. It really took a long time for them to let everybody in. In fact, Kyle Rittenhouse started his speech last night at Kent State in the Kiva Student Center about probably 10 minutes he was speaking before everybody who was going to be allowed in was allowed in, which kind of took us by surprise as we looked around and saw not all the seats filled, because certainly there were enough people outside to fill the seats. Well, turns out a lot of them didn't want to come in. They wanted to stay outside and cause a ruckus, because that's what they do. Those were the protesters. But eventually, the auditorium did fill up. And so I don't know how many of them were my listeners. I do know there was a small group of us, around 9 of us, that sat together. And then as it ended, I had a score of people come up to me individually thanking me for letting them know about Kyle's appearance yesterday and how to get their tickets and how to get in, and that they were huge listeners. And so I can't name them all, but I can tell you this. A lot of people came to me, and they were there last night because of what we did on this program, especially talking to Turning Point USA's chapter president there, as we did yesterday. So thank you to the listeners who came out. It was really, really great to be surrounded by so many patriots who were there to show support for Kyle Rittenhouse and what he continues to face. I want to say thank you also to Turning Point USA and the young sophomore who led that whole thing, Brady Seymour. He was on the program yesterday, along with another student, I believe her name is Jacqueline, who helped organize the event. And I'm telling you this, after watching the chaos that was Memphis, the University of Memphis, in which Kyle Rittenhouse spoke a little over a month ago, I was expecting the worst. This could not have been run any better. They did a phenomenal job of providing security inside and out. There were officers and security guards stationed at every entrance and exit to the auditorium. There was on stage a security force that looked like Secret Service for Kyle Rittenhouse. And I'm talking about 8 guys, all of them wearing men in black sunglasses, who stood at attention all across the stage on either end of it, all in communication with one another. I mean, if anybody would have tried to do anything in that crowd, it would have been just swallowed up immediately by the security forces who were there. I was so impressed. Outside, well, that's where we found the Kent State University and Kent, Ohio police. They were also very large in their presence, and the hundreds of protesters who were outside carrying stupid signs, chanting stupid things, being generally stupid, because that's what left-wing protesters who think that young 17-year-old kids who are being murdered should just shut up and accept their murder quietly rather than defending themselves. That's what they do. That's what stupid people do. But here's the beautiful part. The police out there and the security folks kept them separated widely from the patriots who attended Kyle's talk. As we are, and they, even the exiting of the auditorium was beautiful. By the way, after the bottom of the hour break, I'll tell you what Kyle had to say. But even the exiting, it wasn't just like, okay, Kyle's done, talk's over, get out. And then just, you know, scores of people, some of whom were there to support Kyle, the overwhelming majority, I think, inside. And there were a few sections of people that I would say, based on their attitudes, based on the looks on their faces and their cheering or applauding or lack thereof, based on things that Kyle said, I could kind of tell that they were there not to support, but to harass Kyle. They didn't want them all kind of intermingling on the way out and causing any problems. So they dismissed everybody by section. Took a little longer. But then as the sections exited the auditorium and the building, they walked right out to the throng of probably a few hundred protesters. But they separated us by two layers of bicycle rack barriers. So they really kept apart the patriots from the lunatics, so that there wouldn't be any commingling or any problems. Now, once the patriots exited the building, walked down past the crowd, some of them went in to the crowd to talk to the people and to, you know, ask them why they were doing what they were doing and see, you know, talking about their signs that they were carrying, which was fine. Good. It was peaceful, though. And that's what I loved about it. So I just want to give kudos to, as I said, The young sophomore student who is the chapter president there, Brady Seymour, who did just an amazing job along with his team, along with everybody at Turning Point, along with the security and police forces there, along with Kyle himself, along with the crowd, which was really supportive. And I mean, we were on our feet a number of times during Kyle's talk. We were applauding loudly for so many of the things that he discussed about his experience and about what's going on with respect to the right to self-defense, Second Amendment issues, First Amendment issues, and so much more. He handled everything very, very well, Kyle did. He's 21 years old. He's not a professional speaker. He's not. He admitted that in a private gathering beforehand with people who were given early access, myself included, and some of my friends. You know, he said, I'm a terrible public speaker, but I have some important things that I need to say, and I'm here to say them. And he did a great job of that. The crowd is phenomenal, everything. I just got to tell you, what could have been chaos after what we saw in Memphis. Like I said, I went in there expecting the worst, and instead we came out of there with the best. I think it was the best outcome that could be possible in that circumstance. What did Kyle talk about? I'll cover some of that on the other side of the break. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. Then Jim Jordan, by the way, at 945. Stay here on AM 1420.
The answer.
Okay, it's 9:38. Always Right Radio on AM 1420. The answer. I got Jim Jordan coming up here in about 6 or 7 minutes, so it gives me a few more minutes to kind of recap what happened last night. Yesterday, as I was driving to Kent from my home, I had about an hour drive or so, so I did a little Bob France Road Rants, which I have not done many of in a very long time. I haven't done one in a very long time. It's just been too hectic. Anyway, I did a little road rant, just kind of discussing what Kyle Rittenhouse, why I was going to support Kyle Rittenhouse, and you know, what the whole story was about. Just kind of recapping and reminding people who did not know. And I've got to tell you, I felt very, very good about what I had said in that road rant, because it's exactly what I got out of the event. Kyle addressed all of it. He addressed everything that happened to him. He told the story that was told by video, by the way, as well. It's not as if he was telling it from his perspective alone. Everything that he said was verified and backed up by video because of the number of videos that were taken that night about how it was that he nearly was killed on multiple occasions that evening, how he defended himself, why he defended himself. The circumstances surrounding his presence in Kenosha, all of it. It was extraordinarily important. He was questioned about Second Amendment issues. He answered them effortlessly, smoothly, seamlessly. He was asked about self-defense. He was asked about, you know, whether or not he had any regrets. And he gave such a great, honest answer about that, too, when he said, well, he said, hindsight being 2020, he said, if I would have known that I would have had to defend myself and use lethal force that night, and if I would have known I would have been facing murder charges and the rest of my life in prison, I would not have gone. So, yeah, I have a regret. I have a regret that I ever went. But he said that does not change the fact that I had a right, and we all do, to defend ourselves when we are being attacked. So inside the venue, as Kyle's speech was going on, as you know, there were many applause moments. Not all of them standing ovations, but just loud, you know, applause and cheers for so many of the things that he said that really resonated with a lot of us. And I took note looking around to see who was applauding and clapping and who was not. And there were two sections of audience members. The ones on the far sides of, you know, it's a, think of it as a, you know, like a semicircle auditorium, you know, half circle. And so on the right and the left sides of the stage, there were individuals who were not clapping when the rest of the audience was. They were not cheering. They were not supportive. They just kind of sat there with surly looks on their face. These would be the individuals that I would describe as the protesters who were just waiting for their moment. And sadly for them, their moment never came. There was nothing that was extraordinarily controversial that Kyle said that would give them right or reason, not that sometimes protesters ever need it, to stand up and you know, act the fool the way they did in Memphis. And when it came time for the Q&A, the Turning Point folks who had the microphones in the crowd, they gave people all over the auditorium opportunities to talk, but the mic only made it into those sections one time. And there was one, and it was a relatively benign question. It wasn't really, you know, anything that was extraordinary, and Kyle answered it very, you know, and I'm trying to remember the exact wording of it. It was something to the effect of, excuse me, you know, why would you go into that situation knowing that there was a place of chaos, and why would you bring a big assault rifle with you, which is what they like to call AR-15s, and of course they're not that, but and you know, he said, you looked at a chaotic situation and brought a weapon that can only create more chaos. Why? And it was about as close to a real harsh, critical question that was able to be asked. And he answered it, you know, again, very, very effortlessly. And the reality is he brought that weapon into a chaotic situation because it was a chaotic situation. It's the same reason he brought the medical kit. It's the same reason he was there because he was a lifeguard. A certified lifeguard. Lifeguards, anybody who knows that, are trained in CPR and first aid. They have to be. So he had training in first aid and CPR, and he knew from watching the events of the night before that people were getting hurt. He was there to render aid to people who got hurt. He was also there to protect himself in the event that he was going to get hurt. So that's why you have two different things there. You got the medical kit, but then he's got the AR strapped to his back. And as it turns out, he needed both. He provided assistance to people, but then when he became the subject of attacks, he had to defend himself. So it was a very, very well-run event. Kyle gave a wonderful talk. Like I said, he's not a polished speaker. There weren't a lot of, you know, quips and things that make people laugh and, you know, even super inspirational stuff. It was matter of fact, it was direct, and it was important because we do have the right. He's exactly right. The Constitution says we have the right to defend ourselves, to protect ourselves. And it's very specific, by the way. The Constitution is, of course, about how we may do so with a firearm. Our Second Amendment rights do indeed give us the opportunity to keep and bear arms for whatever protection we need, whether it be from individuals or from a tyrannical government. So I just thought it was a great event. I asked Kyle in the pre-talk section or segment or whatever, in which early invitees were allowed inside, or early entries, whatever you want to call us. It was a little Q&A with him ahead of time, and I asked him what the job situation looked like for him. What is he thinking about for career? He's only 21. Because the reality is, you know, companies aren't looking to hire him. People are a little bit afraid of the drama that comes with him because of everything that his situation entailed. And so he did say that things like he's doing right now, including also political consulting, those are things that he is working into. All right, I'm told Congressman Jordan is on the line now, so let's go ahead and welcome the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee and the Weaponization Subcommittee, member of the Oversight Committee, and our 4th Congressional District Representative, Jim Jordan, back to our program. Congressman, good to have you. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thank you, and thank you for making the time. I know you're very, very busy right now. A lot of things are happening on the Hill, so we'll try not to keep you too long here. But I have to ask you about where things are headed with respect to the Republican majority in the House. Thomas Massey, your colleague from Kentucky, whom I spoke with last week, is calling for Speaker Johnson to step down. He's saying he needs to resign, needs to do so quickly, make the pre-announcement so that we can go ahead and have our vote so that we are seamless and we don't have any period of time without a speaker. This follows, of course, MTG's call for him to be removed as well. He was supposed to be the answer to the problems that were brought up by Kevin McCarthy, and now there are some strong voices saying this is not working. What do you say, sir?
Well, I don't think we need to do that. I mean, look, I support Mike Johnson. I don't think it makes sense to get a third speaker in one Congress. And we got to focus on doing the best we can in divided government for the American people. And then, frankly, winning the election this fall. We need President Trump in the White House. We need to take back the Senate, which I think is going to happen. And frankly, we need to keep the House, because then if we do all that, we can cut taxes. We can get the right kind of energy policy. We can put in place in these key cabinet positions individuals who aren't going to weaponize the agencies against we the people. We can secure the board. We can do the things that need to be done. But if we're constantly fighting amongst ourselves, and then at some point maybe the American people say, wait a minute, do we really want the Republicans in control of the House? So I'm nervous about that. I think President Trump's going to win. Like I said, I think we're going to win the Senate. We need to keep the House. I think the best way to do that is to support Speaker Johnson and get on with this election.
Well, you know, I said many of the same things you just said when the motion to vacate McCarthy came about. We're about to decide who gets to lead this country and have the majority in the Congress, and look at the chaos that we're in right now. And they went through with it anyway. And, you know, obviously you were a part of that because you were actually a nominated speaker for speaker as well. And, you know, I didn't like it then and I don't like it now, but I also don't like what I see. I don't like the fact that you just had that FISA vote, and Speaker Johnson cast the vote that put it into a 212-212 tie that denied the amendment written by Andy Biggs that would have, you know, required a warrant to spy on American citizens. What is the Speaker doing? I can understand why Massey is very, very frustrated here.
Well, I was frustrated with that, too, because this is something I've been, you know, we made it a focus as the Judiciary Committee to get that warrant requirement on the FISA reauthorization bill. And that was the number one. That was what the whole ball of wax was about last week. And the fact that we lost on a tie vote is pretty frustrating, particularly when you think about all the information that gets collected. And if they're going to search Bob France's name, phone number, email in that database, if they're going to do it, they should have to go to a judge and get a warrant. And, oh, by the way, we put in exceptions. We had exceptions in there. So the exception, if it's an emergency situation, you can go ahead and do the search. But short of that, go get a warrant, for goodness sake. And the one question, and I know I'm getting off this a little bit, but the one question that they said that they wouldn't answer is, okay, there were several hundred thousand times that a year that they do these queries, these searches of this giant, what I call the giant haystack of information. Well, when they do the search, how many of them wouldn't be covered by the exception? No one will give us the answer. And if it's a big number, it should scare us. If it's a small number, then what's the big deal? Then it's not going to be some task of having to hire a bunch more judges. I mean, they wouldn't give us the answer that they, meaning the intelligence community. So, again, I'm sorry for going on back on the heart of this, but to me, that was so frustrating that we should have won that vote, and that should be over in the Senate right now, and they should be debating that issue instead of some of the things we're focused on.
Yeah, please don't apologize. It's what I wanted to hear, and I'm glad to hear you say all of that. Here's what I want to hear now. What the hell is wrong with your colleagues in this state? Miller, Balderson, Joyce, who else? I'm trying to Turner. I mean, I think five of the representation of Republican members of Congress in the state of Ohio voted, against the amendment. They don't care if there is a warrant. What is going? I mean, again, we can put all of this on the speaker and he cast the deciding vote, and it should be. But I have severe questions and serious questions for all of the Ohio delegation and also 86 total Republicans who said, "No, everything that Jim Jordan just said is not important."
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't know. You have to ask them. I mean, they're good guys, good members. But I don't have
access. Do you ask them? Do you talk to them, Congressman?
Oh, I talked to Mike Turner a lot because he was he was on the other side on this. But Intel and Judiciary were the two committees that have jurisdiction here. So it was the good news is if you can I mean, I try to look at the positive all the time. The good news is we got 128, I think, Republicans. 60% of the Republican Party was on our side here in the House, and we got 80 some Democrats to vote for it. So that we've never had that kind of number for this kind of policy on FISA and on the intelligence agency. So we think that's a positive. Again, it's not a win, unfortunately. You got to get a majority to win, but it's just frustrating because this is the same FBI that didn't follow their own. The report said that 278,000 times they searched this database and didn't follow their own rules, and now we're supposed to believe, oh, we put new rules on them, they'll follow them. Come on, the only way that this works is in our system, the greatest country ever with the greatest system ever, is if you want to go look through American citizen stuff, you got to go to a separate and equal branch of government and get a probable cause warrant. That's how it's always worked. And why don't we stick with the tried and true method? And we even said, because we're dealing with national security concerns here, if there's an imminent threat, emergency situation, the FBI can do the search of the database on your information, and they don't have to get a warrant. But short of that, go to the judge and get a warrant. Mm-hmm. And still we couldn't win. This drives me. And oh, by the way, Bob, we said we'll even let you go to the secret court, to the FISA court, and we still couldn't win. That to me is like, and the arguments are so strongly on our side. The history, 200 plus years of that system, where you go to the judicial branch, a separate and equal branch of government, to sign off on looking at American citizens' information. I'm getting all fired up again thinking about it, because we had this debate last week and I was speaking on the floor of these same things. But it seems so obvious to me.
I know. And you were fired up then, and you should be fired up now because of the way the results came out. And the American people are worse off for it. And the Fourth Amendment is just being completely kicked to the curb by 86 Republicans. I expect the Democrats to do such things. I do not expect my party, which is supposed to be the party of small government, to do things like this, to allow the government to invade our lives without any warrant, without any just cause whatsoever. So I'm glad you're fired up about it. Hopefully maybe you can pass some of that on to some of your colleagues. Congressman, let's talk about messaging. It's so important that the media give equal opportunity for all sides of the political debate to be heard, particularly from our leaders, but they don't. Even taxpayer-funded media. You know I'm talking about NPR.
Yeah.
NPR was exposed. I mean, not that we didn't know this already by simple observation, but to have a senior editor, a 25-year man, come out and tell the truth about the bias at NPR when it comes to editorial decision-making, the fact that 87 staffers were registered Democrats, zero registered Republicans, and this is taxpayer funded. Marsha Blackburn on the Senate side is calling for the defunding of NPR for this reason. I think there are some folks on your side who are calling for the same. Are you one of them? And what do you say about this?
Yeah, we should definitely defund them. But it is funny because even though we already knew this, the fact that someone on the inside comes forward and confirms what we already knew, what we all suspected, I think just demonstrates how bad the bias is. That it's not even just a bias. It is completely NPR is, let's just be clear, just an arm of the Democrat Party. It's like that's what it is, as evidenced by the fact that the senior editor said, well, everyone there is Democrat. So it's all part of this the left and their control of almost every institution. But as I always say, you know, the left may control big tech, big media, big sports, big corporation, big, you know, Hollywood, higher education. They may control all these institutions, but the left doesn't control we the people. And we the people can see it. And frankly, we the people probably are a little frustrated with our tax dollars going there and supporting a completely left-wing organization. So I think Senator Blackburn is right. Time to say no more NPR, no more funding for NPR.
Yeah, that's the part of it, because you're right. I mean, we can't, you can't, the government can't control the New York Times. You can't control what they do on MSNBC, because
right.
that's freedom of the press. But when they are operating on our tax dollars, you can control some of that bias at NPR, and you absolutely should. So I don't know exactly what it's going to, what it would entail in terms of a motion, a bill on either side to do this. But can you say, even if it's not you, can you assure your constituents right now and my listeners that there is going to be movement or action taken on the House side to take those funds away?
I don't know that it'll happen now, because we've already done the appropriation bill. That's when you got to do it. And we just passed that, you know, that second part of the big omnibus. Right. 2 weeks ago, of course, I voted against it for a host of reasons. The biggest one was the money that went for the new FBI headquarters, for goodness sake. So that's where you got to do it. You got to, in those appropriation, those budget bills, that's where you got to do it. You could introduce a separate bill, but it's better to just be that you go after it on the appropriation. So that's something we should do, with President Trump, because, you know, he would sign it if we got that passed, I believe, where I would almost rather do it on a
separate bill, though, because if you don't, if you include that in the next appropriations, it's going to get swallowed up. And people, you know, people say, well, I really oppose funding NPR, but I'm not going to vote against this giant bill because of that one small thing. It's got too many other good things. I can't stand that process. I think very specifically, NPR is biased. It has been admitted. It has been proven. They're not serving the good of the public and the people because of what they are doing with their one-sidedness and their bias. Therefore, they don't get public funding. They're going to have to raise the money on their own if they want to continue to exist. I think a separate bill is the way to go.
Yeah, no, maybe you're right. Maybe we should do it that way. Maybe we should do it that way.
Yeah.
And I'm all for it. We'll see what Senator Blackburn introduces.
Yep.
But you're right. We shouldn't be giving money to an organization that's just, you know, like, okay, it was such a deal. Your tax dollars go to an organization that comes out, speaks against your issues and what you believe in. Oh, such a deal for the taxpayer. Well, maybe we should stop that.
Amen. We absolutely must do that. Last question for you, sir, because I know you're short on time, and so am I. But you mentioned President Trump is going to win. He's got to get through trials. Last night, Jesse Waters ran down the 7 of the 12 jurors who have been seated thus far. I believe 5 of them said they get their news from the New York Times and from Google, which is very, very troubling. They are claiming they can put their opinions about President Trump to the side and only evaluate his case based on the merits and the law. But there were some of them who tried to cheat their way on. They had posted online, lock him up about Donald Trump, and then they tried to get on the jury.
And they tried to get,
Is there any way, Congressman, he can get a fair trial in Manhattan?
I think it's, you know, look, I want to believe in our system still, but I am a little concerned about the premise of your question there. Now, you know, takes one juror to say, like, to be fair and say, this is ridiculous. All kinds of legal scholars. I mean, Turley's been great when you hear him talk on TV, constitutional lawyer and scholar that he is, about how this is a ridiculous case. A case, by the way, that the Southern District of New York wouldn't take, a case that the Department of Justice wouldn't take, and a case that only really Alvin Bragg took because he got pressured into doing it by Pomerantz, who wrote the book. Pomerantz, who came and worked, you know, volunteered basically to work there and then wrote the book. We actually deposed Mr. Pomerantz. So it's completely ridiculous. I think normal people see that. Whether there's enough jurors in New York who will be fair, I don't know. I don't know. But it takes one. It takes one of them to be fair.
Yeah, and God willing, we get that, because we are in for a world of trouble if they end up convicting him on such ridiculous things, because Lord only knows where they could go after that. Congressman Jordan, thank you for carving out the time. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, sir. Thanks, Bob. Take care.
All right, 9:59, Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. Here's your host, Bob France.
Okay, working our way into hour number two now. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for being with us. It is Wednesday, the 17th morning of the fourth month in the year of our Lord, 2024. We had a really good conversation with Jim Jordan. We spoke at length in the first hour about last night's, or I did anyway, give you a little bit of a recap, as I promised I would, of Kyle Rittenhouse's speech and the entire event at Kent State yesterday. So if you missed that, you're going to want to go back and check it out. It's at, it will be at WHKRadio.com as part of the podcast about an hour after the end of the show. But I want to invite you now to have your say. If you were in that audience last night and experiencing that event with me, and you would like to give us your thoughts on what we did, what we saw, what you expected, we'll open up the phone lines right now. I've got a half an hour before our next guest. We're going to talk at 10:35 with Kate Gorka. That is Dr. Sebastian Gorka's wife, who is not just, well, she's his wife. She's an extraordinary person in her own right. She has a resume that is incredible. We're going to talk to her about a book that she has co-written about Marxism, Next Gen Marxism. So that's coming up at 10:35. But between now and then, if you would like to talk about what you saw yesterday, we can certainly do that with respect to Kyle Rittenhouse. Also want to pay a little bit of attention here to our good friend, producer Seth. Seth, it's an anniversary. Today is the two-year anniversary, right, Seth? The two-year anniversary since you became a partial human pogo stick.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It, 2 years ago today that I slipped into a coma and woke up 3 days later without a leg.
You just because it's a pretty remarkable story. I mean, I suppose anybody who goes through something like this, it's remarkable. But since we have access to you, let's hear yours. Tell everybody exactly what happened and why you have one leg right now.
So I had gone on vacation with my wife down to Savannah, Georgia, and I was laying on a bed. I'll try to make this as quick as possible. And I was looking down, and I see something hanging out of my shoe. And I go to pick it up, and there's a probably an inch-long nail or tack, whatever you want to call it, that was stuck inside my shoe. I pulled it out. I didn't think much of it. I had some nerve pain in my foot or some nerve issues with my foot, so I really didn't feel anything. And I started to get sick and sicker and more sick and more sick. And probably about a week and a half after that, it was April 16th, I lost my mind, went crazy. I was sitting on a couch. My phone was off, but I was playing on it. My TV was off, but I was watching it. And my wife came home the next day. She was out with my daughter. And she came home the next day, found me on a couch, and I was unresponsive. And so she called the ambulance. I was in a coma for 3 days and then woke up without the leg. I had sepsis in my leg from the nail that was in there.
So I'm just, because you and I have talked about this before, but when you saw that there was a nail in your shoe,
yeah.
At that point you didn't turn your foot over to see if there was also a nail in your foot or a hole from that nail in your foot?
To be honest with you, I mean, I know I had felt something, and I don't even know how long the nail was there. I had some nerve issues with my foot, and so I didn't really feel it. I did notice a little blood. I hate to say that, not trying to be gross or anything, but I was always the kind of guy that, oh, it'll get better. I'm not going to the doctor. I've just always been that person. I'm just, okay, it's fine. I got the nail out, so I'll be okay. I don't have to go to the doctor. And kind of ignored it. Thought I just had the flu or something. Or COVID or whatever it was, because, you know, you know what you have these days. And so I was sick with flu-like symptoms, but I didn't think much of it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I thought, I'll get better. Didn't go to the doctor like a dummy. And but it was the infection in my leg. It was in my blood. And
So two follow-ups here, Seth, because you're, you know, first of all, I mean, 2 years later, I mean, what did you think? I'm trying to having a hard time trying to figure out how I want to ask this. When you woke up and realized that your leg was gone, I can't imagine it myself. I don't think anybody could unless you went through it. But you probably didn't at that time say, no big deal, I'll adapt. But 2 years later, here you are, and you have adapted extraordinarily well. I mean, how do you reconcile all that in your own mind?
There were a lot of dark times when I found out what happened. But there isn't an option. I mean, the other option is a lot worse than this. And
yeah.
I'm not going to sit around and cry over stuff. I have no other option but to get up and live. And, you know, that's what I decided to do. I mean, that's why, I mean, when it came to therapy, I was always working hard. And, you know, I talk to guys on occasion who have the same kind of issues that I have, a missing limb, foot, leg, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I try to tell them, like, look, the alternative is a whole lot worse. And so this actually was a blessing for me.
It got a blessing.
In a lot of ways. It allowed me to, one, stop smoking because I was an idiot and doing that. I changed a lot of things about the way that I live my life. It brought me a little bit closer to my family. I know that sounds strange, but it did because, you know, they were there for me, and I had to learn how to do a lot of different things again, and walking and even the simple things of going to bed at night and using the restroom are a lot different than they used to be. And so there are a lot of things that I had to adjust, but I'm happy to do it. And so it gave me a new sense of excitement about life, to be honest with you.
So this is a little bit of a weird question, because now I'm going to tie your story. And happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank you.
Are you going to get an eye patch now and a parrot on your shoulder, too? Or?
Well, I mean, I have a permanent, you know, Halloween costume, so I'm good.
And I love that you are of such good nature about this, and you can laugh about these things. But tying this into news, with this bizarre contagion of self-identification going around now, if I'm a boy, I feel like I'm a girl, I can get that surgically, make that happen, or try to anyway. You do see stories of people saying, I have always identified and felt like I was an amputee, and they're having their arms or their legs or something surgically removed from their bodies. When you see people doing things like that as a person who didn't make the choice, but you just, you know, had this situation happen to you, what message do you have to those people?
You're stupid. I mean, nobody wants to live like this. This isn't something that I would ever choose.
But some do. That's the reason I'm asking.
They're misguided. Like everything else, as you know, when it comes to, you know, identity, and you need help. You need psychological help. Nobody should want to be like this. This isn't something good. I mean, I'm happy. And again, it's a blessing because it happened, but I have to deal with it. I would never wish on it. I would never hope for it to happen. So, yeah, you need help if you have those kind of thoughts. You don't want to live like this. It's a completely different life, learning how to walk again and learning how, I mean, the looks I get when I have to drive a car and I have to take my leg off to get in and I have to take it, you know, put it back on when I'm getting out of the car. You deal with people all the time that are staring at you. You don't want to live like this, no.
Tell people who don't know how you are even able to drive a car. I mean, you've got, this is your right leg. This is your gas brake foot, you know, and now it's on the end of a stump with a shoe on a, that's not a stump. I shouldn't say that. It's obviously a pretty high tech prosthetic you have.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't use it to drive. You can't use it to move your foot back and forth between the gas and brake. So tell people how you drive.
No, I have to, when I get into the car, sit down, take the leg, the prosthetic off, and put that in the passenger seat. And then I have a stick that's next to the console in the middle where you shift to, you know, park and, you know, reverse and all that. There's a stick there that I can push forward to brake and then pull back for gas. And then I use my left hand on the steering wheel and have like a, I don't know what they call those, like a little ball on the steering wheel that you hold on to.
Yeah.
So that's what I, the gas and the brake are in a stick on the right side.
And that's got to be a really, really difficult thing to learn, too, how to accelerate. I mean, unless it was like, you know what I would almost want, but you can't because you wouldn't be able to turn 360 degrees the wheel, but I would almost want motorcycle handlebars. Because, you know, if you know how to ride a motorcycle or anything else where the throttle is on the handle, you know, that would be a little bit easier to use, I guess, you know, with handbrakes.
They have those kind of things for, like, the steering wheel. They do have that. But
do they?
Yeah, this was easier for me, to be honest. It's almost like a video game. I mean, in the snow and everything, it's terrible because you can't have your both hands on the wheel at the same time. But it's really, you get used to it pretty easy.
Yeah, well,
and it's interesting. It's a totally different life.
Yeah, well, it's a crazy, wild, totally different story, man, than I'm used to hearing. So, happy anniversary to you, Seth. I mean, I guess today, this wouldn't be the anniversary. This wouldn't be the day to celebrate, right? This is the day you wait. Well, actually, hold on. Is this the day you lost your leg or that you got your prosthetic?
No, this is the day I lost my leg. Like,
okay, so no, this is probably not the day to celebrate. But I don't want a happy anniversary the day that the bad part happened.
I totally disagree with you.
Really?
This is a day to celebrate because I could have died. And a lot of the doctors told my wife that I should be dead. And so, you know.
So removing your leg saved your life.
Removing my leg saved my life, and I'm so happy to be. Look, in 2 years, I went from no job, no leg, no ability to drive, sitting alone inside my home by myself a lot of days and crying, wishing that it didn't happen, to 2 years later, I'm working on a great show with a great host like you, a guy that I've known for 20 years, and I consider you a friend as well as my boss. I'm working again. I have now 3-4 jobs that I'm doing, and I have a great place to live, and I'm happy with my family. So I couldn't ask for more. Today's a day to celebrate for me.
Well, you know what, man? That's a great story. And that feels really, really great to hear, too. I'm still going to celebrate the day you get do you know what's the anniversary date of getting the prosthetic?
That would be in July.
Okay, so we'll have to celebrate that, too.
Yes.
Because I think that's pretty good, too. Although you did a great job, though, selling this one as even better because of all of the things that it did for you, and it changed your attitude and some of the things about the way you live your life and your health and so on and so forth. So good for you, man.
I appreciate it.
Really, really happy for you, Seth.
And thank you.
Good. And we're very lucky to have you here, too. All right, let's take a short break from that. I do want to open up the phone lines. Like I said, if you were at Kyle Rittenhouse last night, you want to talk about it, 216-901-0945. I also have some more video clips that I want you to respond to. Joe Scarborough and Katie Couric think you are absolute trash. If you're a Trump supporter, you are trash. You are just what they step in when they walk through a dog park. That's how they feel about you. I'm going to play those for you. We'll react to those, and we have a lot more, too, on Always Right Radio, AM 14. Okay, it's 10:21. Thanks for being with us. We're going to talk to Kate Gorka coming up after the bottom of the hour. I want to play some clips for you. This one you heard already if you've been with us since the start of the show. This is MSNBC's resident lunatic, and they have many of them. So who am I talking about? If I say MSNBC's resident lunatic and I ask 5 different people to tell me who that is, I'm probably getting 5 different answers. Somebody's saying Rachel Maddow. Somebody is saying Nicole Wallace. Somebody's going to say Joy Reid. Somebody's going to say Brzezinski. And some are going to say Joe Scarborough. Well, in this particular case, it's Joe Scarborough. Yesterday on Morning Joe, their TV show that from what I understand, nobody really watches, according to the people who chart those sorts of things. I don't really pay attention to it, and I don't really care. But what I do care is what he said. This lunatic said that if you are a Trump voter, there should be serious questions about how you were raised, by whom you were raised, and where you were raised. I'll let his own words do the talking, and then we'll react.
You live in the most powerful, greatest country on the face of the earth? And you're voting for a guy that tells you every day that America sucks? What's wrong with you? Who raised you? Mm. What history did you read?
That's it.
Like, where are you from? Because you may claim to be from where I'm from, but you were not raised by the same teachers I was raised by.
We don't let our teachers raise us. We're raised by our parents, by the way.
And you don't read. Because if you read, Mike, the facts are clear. And I'm getting tired of saying this to people who claim to be patriotic but hate America.
Why are you so mad, bro?
Because they're always running America down. They're always trashing America. They're always saying America's horrible. Its democracy doesn't work. We need a dictatorship if Donald Trump doesn't win.
Yeah, that's what the small government-driven conservatives in this country say. That they want a dictatorship. They want more government. They want big government. Yeah, that's what they say. There's so many things wrong with what the left thinks of you. But I'm reminded when I heard this tirade from this lunatic yesterday morning, and he gives tirades on a regular basis, I'm reminded of Hillary. And, you know, the whole, you know, half of Trump voters can be put into a basket of deplorables. You are deplorable. You are uneducated. You are uncouth. You are rubes. You are hillbillies and rednecks. You're deplorables. This is what they think of you. And the reality is, if this is what I get from this type of modern American or postmodern American leftist, I'll wear those labels with, you know, as badges of honor, quite frankly. But I want to address the main point of what Scarborough said there, and I want to use, you know, I want to use this to defend, I think, all of us that he's talking about. He keeps saying that we're running down America, this great country. We're talking about how much America sucks, and we're voting for a guy, Donald Trump, who says America sucks. That could not be further from the truth. We are not the ones that say America sucks. We are the ones who say that America is glorious, is majestic, is the greatest force for good in the history of human civilization, and that we are trying to stop it from sucking under the fundamental transformation of it that you and your party have begun. Barack Obama, when he was elected, before he was elected, said he wanted to fundamentally transform America. Transform is a synonym for the word change. So why is this lunatic saying that we are the ones who are complaining about America when it is he and his party and his heroes? Obama started it and did it for 8 years. Biden has picked it up to fundamentally change something. If you love it so much, why do you want to change it? We wanted to keep it the way it was. We wanted to keep it a nation of small government where the people are in charge, where law and order was respected, where families were celebrated, where schools were institutions of learning, not indoctrinating, where boys were boys and girls were girls, and nobody was confused about the other, which one was the other. We're not the ones saying America sucks. We are also not the ones that allowed 10 million illegals to come into this country in 3 years to completely change the face of the country from an electoral standpoint, as well as from a cultural standpoint, as well as from a resources standpoint in our communities. We didn't make that happen. You did. Your hero did. We're not the ones that defunded police and have allowed crime rates to spike to levels never before seen in cities all over this country. We are not the ones that said, we're going to kill energy, and then forced, we guarantee.
You don't have to agree, but I want you to look in my eyes. I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel, and I am not going to cooperate with you. Okay?
We're not the ones that are killing American taxpayers' budgets, because they have to pay $3.75 a gallon for gas, over $5 a gallon for gas, and about a year into this plan to destroy the fossil fuel industries. We're not the ones who are forcing inflation at the highest rate we have seen in decades. We're not the ones who are causing that through Bidenomics. We are not the ones who have waged war on children and tried to talk them into this psychological delusion that they're not what their bodies say they are. These are all things that have been done in America by the radical left. And he's going to scream at us and yell at us and saying, if we're Trump voters, we're the ones who are attacking the country. You are the ones who are literally not transforming the country, but I'm going to alter that just slightly and say deforming the country. You are creating a deformed America. Meanwhile, idiot elitists like you sit up there and pretend to be smarter than the rest of us. People like you and Katie Couric, who actually had the gall to go on Bill Maher and say this.
And I feel like, to your point, Bill, the socioeconomic disparities are a lot, and class resentment is a lot, what, and anti-intellectualism and elitism is what is driving many of these anti-establishment, which are Trump voters,
right? Anti-intellectualism. What is intellect? Intellect is intelligence. Intellect is capacity to learn. If we are anti-intellectual, that means she's calling us dumbasses. And Bill Maher, who sometimes appears to have been red-pilled, but is at his core a very, very much a far-left Marxist, but he's nodding along and saying, of course, of course, of course. This is what they think of you. The radical left thinks that you're too stupid to know any better. Just shut up and let your betters guide you. Shut up and let our betters lead us. Freedom, you wouldn't know what to do with it if you had it. Just let big government show you the way. Let big government eventually guide you along the way, and then let big government push you in the way that they want you to go. Because you're too dumb to know any better. That's not the America that we want to protect and preserve. That's the radical, deformed America that you people are trying to create. All we're trying to do is protect the glorious republic that we were gifted by our founding fathers. I would love your response to that. That'll have to come, though, after we talk to Kate Gorka, because that's next on Always Right Radio, AM 1420, The Answer.
The Answer.
10:35 now. We do roll onward on AM 1420, The Answer. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll try to get some phone lines opened up for you shortly, but I've got a guest now that I normally don't read entire bios of the guests that I have on. I'll tell you their title and maybe a line or two of what is relevant to why we're talking to them. But I want to read this person's bio because it's important. Catherine Gorka is an extraordinary person with an extraordinary resume, and I want you to know it. She is the author of a new book, by the way, a co-author, along with Mike Gonzalez, of Next Gen Marxism, What Is It and How to Combat It. And I want you to know, Catherine Gorka is the director for civil society at the Heritage Foundation. Prior to that, a presidential appointee in the Office of Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. She focused on strategies for prevention of terrorism and targeted violence. She was the president of Threat Knowledge Group from 2014 to 2017, providing expertise and training on irregular warfare and terrorism to the FBI, U.S. Army, Special Forces, Marine Corps, and law enforcement. From 2009 to 2014, she was the executive director of the Westminster Institute, which conducted research and education on threats posed by extremist ideologies. She's brilliant. She co-edited the volume Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. Just because she doesn't have her own radio show doesn't mean she is not an extraordinary individual. And Catherine Gorka joins us now on AM 1420, The Answer. Catherine, thank you so much for the time this morning. How are you?
Hey, I am so good and so happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I've been honored to host your husband's show on a number of occasions, and I'm a huge fan of his, but I'm a huge fan of yours as well, and I'm so glad to see that you are out here and sharing this extraordinary important information in this book. So let's dive right in. Ultimately, Catherine, if you could kind of give us a summary here, the multiple issues that we have in this country, the many woes that we are dealing with on a regular basis, are essentially all rooted in Marxism. They can all be traced, or at least have their origins in Marxism. Is that ultimately what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the reason for that is that Marxism, okay, it was, you know, several different things. It was an economic theory, whatever. But the really important thing about Marxism is that it developed a worldview that said the world is divided into two irreconcilable halves, the oppressor and the oppressed. Now, that who fills those two sides has changed over time, right? It's no longer the workers, because we've all figured out workers actually don't want to overthrow their countries. They want to keep their jobs. But this is where we're at today. And you know what's so troubling about it? It's so fundamentally un-American, because what the founders said is that we can come together. We can be very, very diverse people in this country, but we can find a way to come together and solve common problems. And the Marx from the beginning and today's Marxists say, oh, no, you can't solve problems together. We're going to be at war with each other, and one side is going to defeat the other side, wipe them out, and we will take power.
Catherine, great summary, by the way, and you're right about oppressed versus oppressor, and whether it be by class or by race, or now that, you know, there is essentially what we might call critical gender theory, which, you know, if you are a straight person, then you are an oppressor of those who are not straight or those who are queer or what have you. That's a great summary of what Marxism is, but a lot of people don't understand the nuance. they seem to think that Marxism is synonymous with communism and synonymous with socialism. And there are differences among those things, and I've had a lot of people try to explain it. Can you give me your summary of the difference between Marxism and communism and socialism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say socialism and communism, which are, you know, really essentially the same things. You can say socialism is one step on the path. It's the next step to communism, but they're fundamentally the same. They are basically economic versions of Marxism. They say they focus on, you know, state ownership of and getting rid of private ownership, right? What's so different about today, and this is why Mike and I came up with this unique term, next-gen Marxism, because we thought it really needed its own language. You know, what's happened in this country, and it was rooted in the radical student movement of the 1960s, and then it kind of developed, you know, over the decades that followed. Today, the oppressed class, as you mentioned, are those based on sort of immutable characteristics, right? Race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, what somebody might think about their gender. And what the Marxists have done, you know, the people who really want a full-scale revolution, who want to fundamentally change the United States, is they have worked really hard to provoke a sense of grievance among those groups and instilled in them the idea that they have to take down the United States as it is because their problems will never be fixed otherwise.
We are talking with Catherine Cornell Gorka. She is the co-author of Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Her co-author is Mike Gonzalez. So in this book, you talk about the radical left and their destructive agenda. I understand why globalists want to take us apart. I understand. I asked this question. I may have even asked Seb about this at one point or another. I can understand why globalists want to take us apart to advance their one world government, essentially global slavery goals. But why would the most powerful nation on earth, the leadership of the most powerful nation on earth, they already have power. They already have money. They already have, you know, pretty much anything everybody could want. Why would they want to share that with other globalist leaders? Why would they want to take what they already have control and dominion over here in the United States? Why would they want to share that with others on the outside?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. And I think the point is not that they so much want to share it with others, although as Mike and I documented very well in the book, our Marxists here are very much in cahoots with Marxists in Latin America and in Europe. So there is kind of a global movement without a doubt. But I would say it's more about the radical Marxists and the radical left here in the United States wanting to take power from those who they think have power in the United States, right? They want to kick the white heterosexuals out of positions of leadership. And yeah, honestly, this is kind of what they're in the middle of right now, right? They're in the middle of silencing white heterosexuals who stand for sort of any kind of traditional or normal values. And they want to take over with their radical ideology. So I'd say it's more of an internal problem than an external one.
How did they convince academia to go along with this? And I don't mean the higher institutions of higher learning. I'm talking about now at the high school, junior high school, primary grade levels. The teachers' unions and others have to buy into this. If they're truly going to convince an entire, you know, population generations, plural, of the evils of capitalism and of the evils of, you know, the United States as a constitutional republic and somebody, you know, that should embrace Marxism and that should indeed divide from into oppressors and oppressed, they had to get these people to buy in. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of educators. How'd they do that?
Well, it's really because you can't separate the K-12 from the university. So one of the things that happened with the failed student revolutions of the 1960s is Those students didn't wake up the next morning and say, okay, now I'm a conservative. They stayed revolutionary. They went into the colleges and universities. There's a great quote by one of them, Jay Perini, who's a professor of English at Middlebury College. And he said, you know, it might have seemed like we became invisible for a while, but actually we went into the universities. Now we've got tenure. So now we are in the process of radically transforming our universities. And what happens is the universities, think about this, you know, people that go on to teach, they go to college or university. They often go to teachers' colleges, which those are among the most radicalized, right? And they're all getting fed on this Marxist doctrine. So then, of course, they buy into this. And that's, I would say that's largely how it's happening.
We are talking with Catherine Gorka. She is the co-author of Next Gen Marxism, What Is It and How to Combat It? It is already sold out on Amazon. That's how popular this is. It's an amazing read, and I want you to find it where you can get it. Obviously, you know, they will be having new reprints and so forth, but make sure that you look it up. Catherine, I want to talk about the family because, you know, for a lot of people, their first exposure to Marxism was when BLM went viral back in 2020, particularly after the George Floyd incident, and BLM became very, very popular, and people started to take note of who they are. And the founders were essentially saying, you know, when they started to receive their publicity, we are trained classical Marxists, and we begin with the need to disrupt, I think the word was disrupt, the modern nuclear family. Why is it so crucial for them to break up families in order to advance their goals?
Yeah, this is basic Marxism. It was Marx who first argued this. But to be fair, I will say pretty much every utopian that's ever lived since Rousseau, starting with Rousseau and the French Revolution, they've all wanted to get rid of the family. And this is one of the things that we also really talk about in the book. They've all been sexual deviants too, which I find so interesting. So you start to really ask yourself, do their ideologies grow out of their need to justify their own sexuality, right? But they want to destroy the family. Marx actually says, he wants to get rid of marriage, and he just wants a community of women who will be available to men. But the reason they want to destroy the family is because they know that the family is the backbone of society, and it's the backbone of civil society. You cannot disrupt society if you can't disrupt the family. And yes, that famous quote by Patrice Couture saying, we are trained Marxists. And, you know, I just have to add, because a lot of people don't know this, who found Patrice Couture, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, who trained her, who recruited her? It was Eric Mann. And if you remember, Eric Mann was one of the 60 student radicals who then became a terrorist with the Weather Underground, went to prison. And then when he came out, he said, okay, we have to find a different way to organize for the revolution. He created an organization in Los Angeles to organize for revolution. And he says, Patrice Couture, he recruited her at 17. And lo and behold, she goes and founds Black Lives Matter.
Wow. That's a remarkable little note of the history of this. Catherine, you mentioned a moment ago about Marx and what he has said about women and about women should just be available to men and so forth. One would think that leftist feminists would be among the biggest enemies of Marx and Marxism based on what he has said and what his, you know, goal in this utopian vision of his, you know, looks like. Why are feminists not on, you know, not opposing this with everything in their beings?
Well, because I think you have to separate women who care about, you know, women's rights and, you know, equal treatment for women from feminists. Feminists, most of them are fundamentally Marxist. I mean, feminists are people who say, are women who say, men and women can't really get along. We want power. We want, you know, there's a lot of Marxism in feminism, but what's super interesting today, because of the attack on women, whether it's the men in competing in sports, in women's sports, whether it's, you know, transgender men being put in female prisons, which is like really a terrible story that we're not talking about enough. All of these problems, you are now seeing women on the left starting to speak out. And to me, one of the most interesting developments is the coalition that's been forming to fight the transgender problem. There are a lot of women on the left who self-identify as even radical left, but who are fighting the transgender ideology because they think it's destructive for women.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to be one of my next questions for you. I wanted to find out if the transgender movement, Catherine Gorka, is something that is working in concert with this push toward Marxism or if it was coincidental. Because, I mean, it's not as if it used to be called transsexualism and cross-dressers haven't been around for a very, very long time. But to push it mainstream, change it to transgender, draw this distinction between gender and sex in order to do this, I'm wondering, is this an independent thing that just happens to be going on? Because it creates the same kind of division that Marxism does with race and with class and other things as well. So is it just coincidental or was it intentional?
No, it's absolutely all bound up together. And another piece that's bound in with this that people might not think to link with these other movements is the whole pro-Hamas, anti-Israel movement. Again, in the book, we reveal this fascinating history between the Marxists in Europe, who then helped bring about Marxist regimes in South America, who then started collaborating with radical left in the United States and helped give rise to Black Lives Matter. And what's interesting to see is how from those earliest meetings, the pro-Hamas sort of movement was a part of that. So absolutely, these things are all linked.
Catherine Gorka is our guest. She is the co-author of Next Gen Marxism, What Is It and How to Combat It. And so let me ask you, exactly how long does it take to undo the damage that's already been done? Let's assume for just one second that somehow President Trump is able to be returned to the White House despite all of the lawfare efforts to try to stop him. Let's say we get President Trump back in the White House. That's not the only thing that has to happen. Even if we have a majority in the Congress, what exactly will it take to push back on this very, very, you know, rapidly gaining steam and gaining size and power movement toward Marxism?
Yeah, I think I feel this very strongly. You know, 100%, we all know that who's in the White House makes a huge difference, right? But I honestly think we are not going to fix this until we all step up and fix it in our own communities. One of the great blessings for me when I was at the Heritage Foundation is that I got to travel around the country in those early, sort of in that early COVID period, collaborating with these thousands of parent groups that were starting to pop up and emerge to fight back and take back their children's education. That movement, I would say, is still growing. It's still very much alive. And I will just say on a personal level, because I take this very, very personally and very seriously, I left Heritage in actually about 2022. I left so that I could write the book, but I also left because I said, finally, Washington cannot fix this. We have to fix this in our communities. And I started getting much more involved in Fairfax County, which, you know, has in Virginia, which has become like the California of the East Coast. And just last Saturday, I was elected to be the chair of the Fairfax GOP. So, you know, I take this very seriously, and we all need to do this. We all need to step up and get more involved in our communities and really fight back on this.
Kath, first of all, congratulations on your election. That's a very, very important thing. And I agree with you. Politics has to start locally. And we always think that the answers have to come from Washington and from the Oval Office. And you're exactly right. They do not. Change has to begin at the lower levels or the smaller levels, if you will, which leads me to my last question for you this morning. What advice do you have for parents who are willing to get involved, people who are willing to get involved, to run for local offices, to run for school board, or to at least be heard at school board meetings, but they're terrified by the weaponization of the federal government, that they're going to be treated as, you know, white extremists, white supremacists, and domestic terrorists, and so on and so forth? We all know what the Department of Justice has done with the FBI, and even with the CIA at various points. They're getting involved in domestic domestic issues. So they're a little bit afraid. They're afraid to go to a Trump rally or to a school board meeting because they think they're going to get locked up like the J6ers. What advice do you have for them?
Okay, so my advice is, first of all, read our book, because I think it's important to understand the seriousness of what we are up against. And then I would say, read some Solzhenitsyn, right? The Russian writer who talked about the gulags. And you will understand, if you don't stand up, where we are headed. And all I can say to people is, you know, look, Sebastian, you know this. We have taken so many slings and arrows because of serving in the Trump administration at various things. And what you eventually realize is you can withstand all of it. Or think about, you know, the people who stood up to the Nazis. I just think for anybody who has a faith, who has belief in the country, you just have to have the courage to stand up and fight this. And I promise, for all those who stand up, who have the courage to stand up, you will see hundreds of others will come in behind you, because there are so many people who feel this way too. They're just waiting for somebody else to stand up and speak up.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Nobody wants to be first, because, you know, you feel like they're going to quash you and crush you, you know, if you're the first one, so that it does deter anybody else from following in your footsteps. And there is safety in numbers. So I think people need to organize. They got to figure out how to do that. It's kind of funny because the community organizers are the ones who are actually bringing about this Marxist turn to the United States. But we need to organize, let people know that there is safety in numbers, and that there are people who feel like they do. And if you can just unite your forces, you can make an extraordinary change in your own local community, which eventually will spread to some of the larger offices. The book is called Next Gen Marxism. What is it and how to combat it? The emphasis there is on the last part of the subtitle, how to combat this. That's what Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka are talking about in this book. Catherine, thank you for writing it. Thank you for coming on to tell us about it. I feel a lot smarter right now at the end of this conversation than I was at the beginning of it. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Bob, thank you so much for having me on.
God bless you. Thank you. All right, that's Catherine Gorka. Yeah, she is Seb's wife. She doesn't have a radio show. She is no less influential, though. She's incredible. And I highly recommend this book. Time out now. Top of the hour. We're going to come back, and I think we'll have open phone lines the rest of the way. Yeah, we will. We do not have an 1110 guest scheduled, so if you want to get in at 216-901-0945, this is the time. 888-281-1110. The final hour is yours. Stay here. It's Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer.
This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
Okay, 7 minutes after 11 o'clock. That means hour number three has commenced on this Wednesday, the 17th morning of the fourth month, the year of our Lord, 2024. Thanks again to Catherine Gorka. Phenomenal explanation of the dangers of Marxism and exactly what the agenda is in the United States. And I still think globally it is just as much, if not more, of a concern. I mean, yeah, it is. It is taking place. It is growing and being fanned. The flames of it are being fanned by, yes, radical American Democrats. But this is clearly a globalist movement that the United States and those Democrats have embraced. That's the reality. So great conversation with Catherine Gorka. I appreciate that. We had Jim Jordan on in hour number one. Covered a lot of important ground there as well, including a new movement to oust Speaker Mike Johnson, this time from Representative Thomas Massie from Kentucky. We just had Massie on last week. Great conversation. He's very concerned about a lot of things going on Capitol Hill right now. But just, what, about a week after our conversation, he is now ready to make a motion to vacate Speaker Johnson because of Johnson's selling out of the American people. Quite frankly, by voting against and ultimately defeating an amendment that would require a warrant to surveil American citizens, to look into their online activity, to look into their communications or anything else. It is just beyond the pale. And I have to say, I don't want to see any more chaos in the Republican Party than we already have. But the reality is, chaos is here. If you've got a speaker who is acting like a Democrat, then chaos is here. That's what Rand Paul said, by the way, and he was right to say it. That it's kind of hard to tell the difference where the Democrats end and Mike Johnson begins right now. So we had that conversation, or part of that conversation, with Jim Jordan this morning. And if you want to weigh in on it, you can certainly do that. Phone lines are open. We're going to do kind of a free-for-all rest of the program, because we did cover a lot of ground over the course of the last 2 hours. So whatever you want to respond to from the top 9 at 9, from the interviews we've done, or if you were an attendee last night at the Kyle Rittenhouse event at Kent State, I definitely want your opinion on what you saw and how things went there. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. We're going to start there, in fact, with Charlie. In Brownhelm. Charlie, you weren't there last night, were you, Charlie?
No, I wasn't able to be there, but I did watch the local news, and I was very surprised they covered it. And that, you know, and they showed there were thousands of people waiting in line outside, and it was supposed to only fit 400. So it was just, I was very surprised that they covered it.
How did they cover it? How did they cover it?
Well, just that it was happening. You know, it wasn't really commentary, but it was that it was happening, and that they covered that it was happening, you know, is surprising, because most stuff at Kent, you don't know what's going on at Kent.
Well, but ever, yeah, so. I mean, no, I'm not surprised that they covered it, because it's Kyle Rittenhouse. He is a nationally known name, famous in some circles, infamous in others. And the fact that he was coming, and he is on a college tour, he was at Western Kentucky, he was at the University of Memphis, and you know, I mean, it's been a very widely covered issue.
We covered it on all three stations. I mean, all three stations I looked at. So that, you know, it's local. So, you know, people got people's attention, and I'm thinking that's good.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, but like I said, I don't think they had a choice. They absolutely had to cover it. I saw all of the TV cameras in the back of the auditorium where we were yesterday. But I'm curious. I have not watched any of the local news reports on it, though, and I'm curious to see how they spun it. Because, like, somebody sent me this on my email a little bit earlier this morning. It's Kent State's newspaper, if you will, their online news journal, and it essentially, instead of focusing on Kyle Rittenhouse, it focuses on the activism of the students outside. Kent State experiences day of activism. The Kent campus remained peaceful during speeches and protests. And then it kind of just talks about it featured the one of the individuals that Kyle Rittenhouse shot, the one that survived, whose name was Gage Grosskreutz or something like that. Grosskreutz. He changed his name to Paul Prediger for whatever reason, but he was there yesterday, Charlie. He was actually there outside doing a speech to the protesters, you know, somehow condemning Kyle Rittenhouse. And so they chose in the Kent State news to focus on the protests and not the actual speech. So I was curious to see how the, since you watched it, I'm curious to see how the local news network news, 3, 5, and 8, and 19 covered it, because, the focus should have been on what Kyle Rittenhouse said and the fact that it was a wonderfully organized and well planned and well attended event.
Yeah. Just another showing of our divide in this country. There's, you know, people who wanted Kyle Rittenhouse die as a divide in this country, the Patriots that didn't.
Yeah.
So,
and that was brought up last night, by the way. That was brought up last night, that Gage Grosskreutz, who was the one who pointed the gun at Kyle, and then got shot in response. He literally said in the trial that he wished he had finished him, that he wished he had killed Kyle on that day. He literally declared that he wished Kyle Rittenhouse was dead. So that's what they wanted. And, of course, Kyle Rittenhouse didn't comply and didn't grant them their wish and just to die peacefully. He actually defended himself, which he has every right to do, which, of course, is why we, you know, sit here having this discussion right now about him. So, anyway, what else do you got, Charlie?
What I was calling, for years and years, I've protested outside of Planned Parenthood. And, you know, I've seen the girls that work there. Well, the other day I decided to protest early in the morning. I was out there with my sign. And I'll tell you, something's changed at preterm. Every woman that went in to work there had a beard.
What?
Seven women with beards. And I'm going, what has happened to our society? I mean, of course they're going to be.
Are you sure they were women with beards?
No,
I mean,
no,
what were they wearing?
These were women with beards. They had the blue hair and beards. And it's like that's the new thing, I guess. They take male hormones and work at preterm. But I was shocked. I'm going, this is a, maybe there is no coming back to this country. I pray that Trump wins. But I don't, like you said in the last, with Ms. Gorka, we might not be able to fix this. This is Marxism is crazy. So,
well, I'm not shocked by it. I'm just disgusted by it. And thank you, Charlie. And thanks for the call, Charlie. You have people like this. We know they're there because we see them online all the time. This is the whole thing. And yeah, they're taking the cross sex hormones and they're trying to transition and all these other things. But they're usually, you know, pretty few and far between. They're not in, you know, big hordes all working at preterm, for crying out loud, to say something like that. So, and I can only imagine what a woman going in there thinks. You know, when they see this, you know, the reason I asked what they're wearing, are they identifiable as nurses or just everybody wearing scrubs or whatever the case might be? Are they identifiable as women, I mean, or are they all just wearing the same thing? I don't know. But these people freak me out. You're right. It is a sign of the times. This is Mike Goldstein. Our friend Mike Goldstein from Proclaiming Justice to the Nations is on the line with us. Mike, good morning.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. I got an email from you this morning. I didn't expect a phone call as well. How's it going?
Oh, it's going very well. The email's on a completely different subject than what we're talking about today.
Okay, what are we talking about?
I've got comments about what Catherine said and some advice. And then if we have time, I want to talk about Kyle Rittenhouse for a second.
Go ahead.
Catherine ended her your interview about telling people they've got to get active, but I have some more specific advice. We are desperate for people to get on their local school boards. The only way we're going to change things is to replace the idiots who are there now. You can watch them on YouTube Shorts. You know, parents are talking. But until you get those people out, and it may take two election cycles, you've got to do the work. Now, if people want to look at this, they can talk to their local GOP. Or in the Cleveland area, they can talk to protectohiochildren.net. But there are, and I've gone through some of the courses here, local and national online courses. They will teach you how to run for school board, and it's all free. They will teach you what to do, how you set it up, what you have to know to be on a school board. And then there were other classes for current school board members about how to do their job better. But it's not a frightening thing. It takes a big commitment to run for school board and to be on it. But that's the way to protect our children. We got to get the idiots off the school boards, because you can yell at them and scream at them in their public sessions. Won't change a thing. They must be replaced. You need a majority of conservatives on the school boards, and it can be done. And groups, Republican conservative groups all over the country, are looking for potential school board members. Please get active and do that.
I don't know. Do you know, Mike, when you were living here in Northeast Ohio, do you know Jeremiah Sawyer by chance?
Sure. Yes.
Jeremiah is the founder of the Ohio School Board Constitutional Coalition, and it's built for exactly that. I don't know how many of these groups there are and organizations there are, but it is literally built to identify and recruit and to elect school board members who are literally going to advocate for education of kids, and literally just teaching kids the way they were supposed to. Schools were never intended to raise kids. They were there to teach kids. It's parents outsource that job. that they didn't have the time and in some cases the ability to do, which is to teach my kid algebra. If a parent can't do it, you know, the teacher can teach my kid maybe to understand classical literature, to understand science. And, sure. You know, that's what schools were supposed to be for. And now that they're trying to let the schools raise the kids in lieu of the parents, we do have to take it back. And so I just want to shine a light on, because you're right. Everything you just said is spot on and everything Catherine said. But look to places like the Ohio School Board Constitutional Coalition. Get involved. And if you need to start one in your particular region of the state or region of the country, I encourage people to do that because, like I said, identifying, recruiting, electing, and retaining these school board members is literally the only way we're going to change the face of education.
Well, that's right. And local conservative organizations are always searching for candidates for their school boards. You can, and first, you can attend a couple school board meetings, local ones, and don't talk the first time or the second time. Just watch, see what happens. And if you don't want to be identified, they're mostly live streams. You can watch them from the safety of your own home until somebody violates your Fourth Amendment rights in your own home.
That's right.
But learn about it. And please, I implore people who are conservative, and a lot of us have been learning, that now we're hungry for something to do. That's the most effective thing you can do.
Completely agree. What did you have on Kyle Rittenhouse?
Yeah, okay, well, my wife Bev and I were at a conference in a big mega church in Phoenix a couple years ago, and about 2,000 people there. Many national speakers were up there talking, and Judge Jeanine Pirro was talking, and she was talking about the rule of law. She's a very good speaker, and she was talking about she was hoping the Kyle Rittenhouse jury would follow its own conscience and follow the law rather than the pressure that was being put on them by the media and the left. And then all of a sudden, people in the audience started yelling and cheering because we were getting notifications on our phone that the Kyle Rittenhouse jury was in and they had acquitted. Okay. And Jeanine had no idea what was going on until the people in the front rows told her, and she had to completely change her speech, and she did a great job. And by the way, she made a point. Make sure that you get on juries. Get yourself into the jury pool. We need conservatives on juries. She made that point. But I wrote an article about this. It appears in AmericanThinker.org about what it was like to be in the audience when 2,000 of your closest patriotic friends learned about the jury verdict. It's a very short piece. If anybody wants to look it up, it's in the
archives. I want to look it up. okay. I'm looking it up right now,
archives,
as long as you're saying
the way,
it. Yeah.
The author index is crazy because it's by alphabetical by first name. So to find my articles, you have to look at Michael, middle initial S, Goldstein.
I've got your article and blog post list on American Thinker right here. What was the title of that one again, Mike?
Oh, I only have about 12, maybe. It's one of the latest.
You've got critical race theory. You've got veterans protecting the country. You've got SPLC slander. You got Democrats tearing the nation asunder. You've got the Department of Education. You got inner cities, you got ISIS, you got ISIS again, you got Americans not being fearful, VA, and limits on veterans' religious freedom, Muslim immigrants, and fantasy war reporting. I don't see it, Mike. None of those seem to be about the jury thing.
I did notice that in the archives, all of my articles except one are on one post, and then my one other article, which is probably that one, is on a second post.
When you find it, you send it to me. I'll make it easy. I make this easy. I make it harder for you. You do the work and send it to me, and I'll take it easy.
In your copious spare time, you can read the other articles.
Yes, yeah, all of that spare time that I have. Yes, no, right. but you know, your point about juries is a good one. And since you just brought it up, Clay Travis made some headlines. He went on Twitter and posted a video from Outkick, the coverage, or actually it used to be called Outkick, the coverage. Now it's just Outkick. But Clay Travis is drawing a lot of heat from a lot of people because he basically went on online and told somebody of the one or two conservative-minded people who might live in Manhattan. And I think the political party breakdown is like 90% of the registered voters in Manhattan are Democrat. So to find one of the very, very relatively few to do this might be very hard to do. But he said all it takes is one Republican sneak onto the jury. He said, find a way, give them the answers they want to hear, make sure you sound impartial, get onto the jury, and then foil the whole thing. Stop them from convicting, make a hung jury. And I got to tell you, they're already sneaking leftists who hate Trump onto that jury. They're trying their best anyway. So you know what? I'm tired of fighting, I'm tired of fighting a losing battle. I want to fight fire with fire, and if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes.
Well, as an attorney who has selected jurors, I don't recommend that you tell anything other than the truth when they're asking you questions in voir dire. But, you can, if you feel you can reach a fair verdict, then just keep telling them that.
You know, Mike, I don't disagree with you. And in ordinary times, I would say Mike, the attorney, is spot on. Don't lie when you are being questioned about your impartiality or whatever they're asking you during voir dire to choose a jury. Don't lie. I agree with you, Mike. On principle and in ordinary times, but these are extraordinary times. They are. I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say. You tell me if you agree with this, Mike. I don't think it's a stretch to say the future of this republic hinges upon this November's election. And if they stop democracy in its tracks, meaning if they take the choice away from the American voter by taking one of the two candidates, the leading candidate, by the way, according to the polls, the leading candidate off of the ballot by locking him up in prison on bogus charges like these. I feel like this extraordinary assault on democracy, this extraordinary assault on the republic, is worth somebody doing something extraordinary in response. And if that means foiling their attempts to railroad the man to prison, then do it. That's how I feel.
Well, two things. You've got to get on the jury. And you can do that by, they'll have your entire background there when you're there. And these aren't all necessarily national issues. Local juries, they'll have your background. They may not have looked at your background very well, which is often the case. Deb was on a jury panel, and as soon as the prosecutor found out that her husband was an attorney, just asked questions of her about me, and then let her be on the jury. And they acquitted. And I said, well, why did you acquit? She said, because the prosecutor did not prove every element of the crime, and that's her job. So we acquitted. That was an armed robbery case. So they don't necessarily, the lawyers don't necessarily do their job. Now, in a national trial like this with Trump, of course, they know every little fact about every juror. And you can't hide those facts, but you can just keep saying, I could give a fair and impartial verdict after listening to all the evidence.
Well,
and
suppose
the second point is, this national persecution of Trump, if he goes to jail or if he loses because he has to spend the entire campaign season in court, sitting in a courtroom,
mm-hmm.
that's the thing, that's the stuff that revolutions are made of.
Well, that doesn't make me feel any better.
And if they take away your right to vote for the person that you want, which is what they're doing, on purpose, that's what leads to revolution. I don't know. I just said having fantasies of this is so unprecedented. Maybe somebody can file an original action in the Supreme Court saying, look at this. This is a conspiracy of jury of election suppression.
Yeah, of course it is. But anytime Donald Trump says that, they slap him with a gag order. And, unfortunately, there's not a. Well, I know, but he's. But he's the only one who's got a big enough platform to do it, because the regular media isn't going to say that. Nobody in the mainstream media is going to say it. and getting the Supreme Court or somebody to take it up is a very, very uphill fight. So, Mike, I'm out of time. Well, I appreciate your call, and
sure,
I appreciate
Bob,
your perspective.
You.
As always, thanks so much, and thanks for the email. We'll talk about Israel later on. Mike Goldstein, we'll take a time out here. It's 11:28. Always
The Answer.
Okay, it's 11:35. Thanks for being with us on AM 1420, The Answer. Let's get a few more phone calls in here in the final segment of the broadcast. If you missed Jim Jordan and Catherine Gorka, our guest earlier on, their interviews will be a part of the podcast, which will be loaded about an hour after showtime. So you can check it out at whkradio.com. Charlie, the politically incorrect mechanic from Flakewood, by way of Kent State University last night. Hey, Charlie, what's up, buddy?
How you doing, Bob? Good morning.
Doing well, my friend. Nice event last night, huh?
Yeah, that couldn't have gone any better. It couldn't have been ran any better. The people at Turning Point did an excellent job vetting people, making sure the people that wanted to be in that room were in that room for the most part. And they, like you said, they let a couple undesirables in a few minutes before Kyle came on the stage to start talking, but that's all right. And then, but you know, they stayed nice.
And you know what, to their credit, by the way, to the credit of the people that I would describe as probably non-supporters, I don't want to use the word undesirables, but non-supporters of Kyle. And you could tell again when everybody was clapping and they were the only ones who were not, you can kind of tell what their agenda was, but they didn't act out. They didn't scream out. They didn't try to disrupt. They were peaceful and that's all you ask for. You don't, everybody in a room doesn't have to agree, but be peaceful and respectful. Let everybody talk and away we go. And they did that. So I was very, very happy with the way it went.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here. And same thing, the campus police and the police for the city. With keeping the protester group outside, you know, before we walked in there, everything was relatively quiet. I mean, I was really surprised. I didn't see, you know, maybe five or six people that I thought were, you know, a problem. But then, I guess the tactic is to wait and assemble to be a problem when it comes time for us to leave. But you know, they maintained like probably I'd say 30 feet of separation. And then I don't know about you, but when I walked out of there, I pretended like I was a rock star, and you know, greeting the fans, and it just, you know, agitated them a little bit more, and I don't have a problem with that. And then there was even some pro Trump people holding signs and stuff out there too, right next to the people protesting Kyle.
Yeah, there were.
But
and,
yeah, it was a great event. There was one thing that there was one sad part. I don't know if you touched on this at all, but I know you were talking to him too. There's some college kids there. They were like-minded. You know, they were supportive of Kyle. I think the one kid said he was a sophomore, is in second year, and I asked, you know, why don't you join Turning Point? You know, they only have 12 or 15 people in their chapter right now, and he's scared to death of never being able to get hired and never being able to finish college. God forbid a professor that disagrees with him finds out about his political beliefs and fails him just for that. Or if somebody won't hire him in the future. And that's something, you know, this discrimination on political grounds, I think is going to be the next thing here, the next major, civil rights.
Well, it's already a thing because they decide your politics.
It.
Yeah, oh, I was going to say because they decide your politics based on whether or not you're DEI. If you don't fit one of the DEI, you know, or if you aren't, you know, if you don't fit one of the categories of DEI, if you're, you know, from a racial standpoint or a sexual orientation or what have you, for diversity and inclusivity and so forth, then you better be, if you're a straight white person, you better be committed to it and have written papers on it and been publicly advocating for more diversity in your space, or else you have no shot at anything. So it's already a big, big civil rights battle, and the discrimination is not against the minorities, it's against the majority.
That's right. So, but yeah.
I'm glad you reminded me of that. I forgot about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Anything else?
I had a blast, and no, everything went real good.
No. My call screen says you wanted to talk about NPR.
Oh yeah. So it looks like that guy that wrote the article about the liberal bias at NPR,
Yuri Berliner,
quote unquote resigned. We all know what that means when somebody with a disagreeing opinion resigns from someplace, it means they were forced out and bullied into resigning.
Yeah, and, I was going to say, I don't think he was forced out. I think because they suspended him for 5 days, which right. is probably more what you just said. That part is kind of forcing him out because they're making it known, we don't like you, we don't want to work with you anymore, you're under suspension. And he basically said, I'm not working like this.
Right.
Because
yeah.
I do have...
Well, good on him. I hope he finds a job somewhere where he's appreciated for his honesty.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. It should be 5 seconds before he's offered a job at Fox News or at Newsmax or at OANN or somewhere.
Salem News.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he's an editor. It kind of lends. I don't know. Maybe Salem. I don't know. What, but the point is, yeah, because he had the guts to be a whistleblower and tell the truth about this taxpayer-funded organization that is not giving people information objectively, that literally has a political agenda. And you know what? Whistleblowers in the conservative sphere are celebrated for having the courage to do that
yep.
and put their career on the line. So hopefully he's going to get offered a big fat salary, to a big increase in what he was making over at NPR, and he goes from there. But yeah, it's a sad situation when you get your career ended, or at least that particular part of your life, your career, this job ended. Because you had the guts to say, hey, what's happening here is not right.
Yep. That's a real shame. But anyways, thanks for what you did to help get people there last night.
You bet, man. Thanks for coming. It was an awful lot of fun, and I was glad to have you there, too. Thank you, Charlie. Appreciate you.
See ya.
All right, buddy.
Bye.
Yeah, by the way, his statement says, I am resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I have worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I do. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism, but I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problem at NPR that I cited in my Free Press essay. End quote. That's what he said in a statement that was published on Twitter/X. So there you have it. And I will have a lot more on this tomorrow, I can promise you. Derek is in Richfield. Derek, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
With what Mr. Goldstein was saying, I just wanted to tell everyone how one of our associate pastors at our church did a couple years ago. He ran for school board, and he did get on it. There was pushback when they knew, you know, he was a pastor and everything, but he's on the Brunswick school board, so it is possible people can do it. and as far as and talking about the jury, that's how the founding fathers set up the checks and balances, that they knew that the government left unchecked would eventually go into a tyranny, and the final power was always left with the people in the form of the grand jury. Unfortunately, jurors don't know their true power. They were not educated because of civics being taken out. I called into Dr. G trying to discuss this with the power of the grand jury, and he said, and he basically kind of shut that down. Well, everyone's totally biased anyway, so that wouldn't even work. There are organizations like Pastor Ernie Sanders had a guest on who his organization is called Tactical Civics, and I think he's in Ohio. Maybe that's someone you might be able to have as a guest on to discuss that also. It was always left with the people in the form of the grand jury. So there's that, because there's always so much to add to it. But I wanted to add for anyone who, like myself, I couldn't get a babysitter. I tried. I wanted to go last night. But 3 hours after the event was over, somebody did put on YouTube his entire speech. Actually, I think it was only 36 minutes that he spoke, but it was over an hour and a half because it shows the crowd outside, but it shows everything from the back. So I, I,
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.